Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show, and I hope you're having a lovely bank holiday weekend. And our panel are here to add to your enjoyment of your bank holiday Sunday, but we'll have a look at the front pages first. So Sunday Times has an interesting front page story. So the headline is Ireland's 5 billion bill for missing climate targets, and that is that if we only get to 29% by 2030, which is what we're on track for at the moment, we will have to buy carbon credits from other people. But down in it, so first, the worst kept secret in showbiz, if you will, is that the housing targets are going to be changed to at least 50,000 a year under a revised Housing for All plan in the autumn. But then they talk about, ministers are discussing using 3D technology, 3D printing technology and prefabricated construction components such as windows, doors, flooring and roofing. It can mean that a unit can cost up to 15% more than a home built in a traditional way, but you can deliver in 18 weeks apparently. And I think a lot of people do wonder, like, are we not getting better and faster and more efficient at building houses? Everything's changed, the internet, AI, etc. So Maybe we are. The Business Post has revealed Johnny Ronan lands backer in fight for prized assets. And I am going to put up my hands there and say I've lost track of Johnny Ronan trying to buy back properties he owned with someone else's money and all that. But anyway, that's ongoing. The Sunday Independent has a poll. Independent groups now ahead of all big parties is the headline out of that. And we'll come back to that. The Irish Mail on Sunday has quotes, we can't blacklist children's hospital builders, cabinet is powerless to bar BAM from public contracts. And the point is made in the piece that there, you don't have that many options when it comes to these kind of mega projects, so it's difficult to exclude anyone. The Irish Sunday Mirror have a world exclusive. So it's fair play to Stormy Daniels. When she wanted to break her silence after the Trump verdict, she came to the Irish Sunday Mirror, and the headline there is Jail Him Now. And the Irish Sun on Sunday is leading with that Strictly has signed up a blind comedian, Chris McCausland, in a new first for the hit show. Okay. Our panel today, Gerard Howland is a public affairs consultant and an Irish Times contributor. Elaine Loughlin is a political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Dr. Mary McAuliffe is a UCD historian and lecturer in gender studies. And Larry Donnelly is a columnist with the journal.ie and a lecturer in law at NUI Galway. And good morning, everybody.
Morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Brendan.
Larry, seeing as we have you here, the Trump is the big chatter of the last few days, there is a poll that the Mail on Sunday have, I think, from America. You think this is hugely significant? I suppose people have been wondering, you know, what effect does this have on the voters and how they're thinking and everything. So
a poll taken on Friday after the verdict was issued indicates that 1 in 10 Republicans say they are now less likely to vote for Donald Trump. Given the margins, and if you look at the margins in the battleground states, they are razor tight. If that were to hold up, and I'm not convinced it will, but if that were to hold up, that could mean the difference in the election.
Okay, because the kind of conventional wisdom up to now has been that where this could play is at the small margins of undecideds and everything, but that those who had decided for Trump would double down, and those who didn't like him anyway would still not like him. You're suggesting this poll might suggest that some Trump supporters might have been put off by
these
his
are
conviction.
These are people who I think support Trump because they broadly agree with him on the issues. They probably don't like him very much. As such, they can be swayed by the jury finding. There is a narrative out there that says, oh, this is only going to help Trump. This is going to deliver him the White House. That's not true. I mean, the base will stick with him. But I think it certainly is going to cause some doubt. I mean, the label convicted felon in the United States, as just about everywhere, is significant and carries with it a lot of weight. And even though people, myself included, have questions about the jury's decision and think that it was a weak case that was terribly defended.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to you on that if I can in a minute. It's interesting.
Even though people have doubts about that, he is still nonetheless been seen to be a convicted felon, convicted by 12 people.
Gerard Howland, you're an old school political strategist. You've worked with Fianna Fáil and that. What's your read of the last few days and Trump and what it means for him?
Well, I may well have weakened him with some people initially, and let's see how that pans out. But I'm sure it's strengthened him with a lot of people. I made a point of listening carefully to what what pro-Trump people were saying, what are the key words and language they are using. And we forget, particularly those of us who don't like him, basically, and don't want him, we forget what a highly effective communicator he is. You go back to his stump speech in 2016 that improbably got him into the White House. Listen carefully to the key words he uses. He stood there outside that courthouse and said to his people, "It's just me standing between you and them. They're coming for you." Yeah. This is a great battle, great cultural war that he is generating interest, passion and belief in. And what will count in this election are very small numbers of people in a very, very few states.
Okay.
As it did before.
I'll come to the others in a minute. Can I ask you this, Gerard? One thing I was thinking, looking at him, and you know the way you think with any bad habit, what's it doing for people? Because a bad habit is doing something for a person. That's why they keep it up. What's he doing for his supporters? And I wondered, is it to do with he is saying to them, what you were saying there about, look, they're coming for ye, I'm just in the way. He's saying to them, you're okay. I see you. I understand you. You're not bad people. Is that what it is like? These people who have been told they are deplorables and everything else, who are snootily looked down on by half of America, Trump is saying to them, you're okay. That's more powerful than kind of anything, isn't it?
Yeah, well, when I use that word deplorable, it's a very important word in the context of this conversation. It's the word Hillary Clinton used in 2016 to describe those people who were against her. She succeeded in losing every single rural county in the United States of America. But to fast forward to where we are now, I think, yes, it is about saying to those people, I am of you, I am for you, I have you. The establishment doesn't care about you. But it's much bigger than that, that we are in a generation-long, huge cultural change where the standing of working people based on old industries, on secure jobs, on trade union memberships is completely gone. And there is great profit and prosperity for many. And there is great insecurity and worry for many more. And it is in that divide, which is a relatively new phenomenon, that he is prospering. He is prospering and feeding off worry. And the worry is sometimes very well founded. If that steel mill you are working in is closed and the business has gone to China, you may actually be in a very good job and well-educated and doing well, but you're in a precarious situation because new industries that pay well for educated people, there's no lifelong jobs in anyone for them. And those technologies and ways of life that you are doing so well out of now, they may not exist or employ anyone in 10 years' time.
Dr. Mary McAuliffe, I'd say you have a very particular prism of this as a lecturer in gender studies and a staunch lifelong feminist.
Yes. Yes, I would agree with what Larry and Gerard were saying, but I would go, I think if you mine down into it, it is a culture war, but it's a particular type of culture war that cuts across race, gender and class. And women voters, outside of maybe white women voters, are a group that Trump does not have any purchase among. And I think this will increase that because of his... I think the way that his team went after Stormy Daniels in the court case again showed that misogyny that is very much part of his shtick, I suppose, his package that he sells to the people. And I think the culture war is about the loss of the white middle and working class industrial base. They are the ones who are really losing out, they feel, in America. And Trump, of course, delivered for the white evangelicals and other evangelicals with the reversal of Roe v. Wade. So he is a very big job to get back that female vote. And I don't know if he will, because he keeps doubling down on this idea of the culture wars coming from that very conservative white
base. I had a really fascinating conversation with Naomi Klein around her book, Doppelganger.
Yes.
But it was about that mirror world and everything. But one of the points she made was that the MAGA movement, the strategy for this time around was MAGA plus, right? And they needed new constituencies in there. And critical to them was what they call the moms.
Yeah.
And that the pandemic and the whole stuff around vaccines and everything had actually helped them to get the kind of yoga moms and stuff into the MAGA thing. But that is a crucial constituency for Trump.
It is very much. And yes, the COVID pandemic worked on that. But they are losing them now. When you see, as Roe v. Wade threw back reproductive rights on the individual states, and some of the states are going... Handmaid's Tale on reproductive rights. It's now suggested in Texas that there would be a criminal prison sentence for any doctor or indeed anyone seeking to have an abortion, even in the case of a woman's life being in danger. And we're getting stories out of places like Texas of women who are something similar before we repeal the eighth here in Ireland, of women who are having whose life is in danger because of a pregnancy gone wrong, and who are having to carry to term, a fetus that has died in the womb or that has no chance of living, that fetal abnormalities, and that their own lives are in danger, and doctors are afraid to treat. This is very familiar to us in Ireland. So the fact that the right is going that far on reproductive rights in certain states, some of them the battleground states, I think is going to come into the mix as well, that may counteract the identification with Trump of his MAGA base. And I think Larry and Gerda are right, this conviction of Trump really will solidify that identification with him, because they can do it to you.
The reason that Trump did all this as well was because he was concerned the reason he hated it all was because he says he was concerned what women would think about him. Elaine, what do you reckon?
Yeah, and I think we've been focusing on the strengths of Trump, but you have to remember sometimes an election is won based on the weakness of your rival. And right now, Joe Biden is just seeing a drift in his support, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later on the panel, but his stance in relation to Israel and Gaza has seen Democrats, especially young Democrats, just fall away from him. And ironically as well, there will be a third candidate, a former Democrat, on the ballot papers in some constituencies in America. That's RFK, a very controversial figure, and perhaps he could be a member of a family who is perhaps one of the most famous Democratic families that could deny Joe Biden the presidency for a second term.
Yeah. So, Larry, did the Democrats have any choice but to go with Biden? He's a name, he's beaten Trump before, etc.
Absolutely, they had a choice. This narrative that's out there that Biden is the nominee because there was no one else is deeply flawed. Biden is the nominee for a variety of reasons, many of them having to do with structure and power and the fact that it's politics is an insider's game. Everyone knew, behind closed doors, everyone knew his running again was going to be a big problem, but he effectively boxed off the field with he and his allies. Again, the almighty dollar rules American politics, and he was able to do that. If the Democrats had...
You're making him feel much more ruthless than most of us imagine he is.
Look, Uncle Joe didn't get to where he is by being Uncle Joe. That's the reality of the situation. Now, if the Democrats...
So he was pretty determined, yeah? It's almost presented as if Joe is going again because, I'll do it for the sake of the party and America, really, yeah.
What I can say, and this is based on from people who know him, is that he is nearly obsessed with proving people wrong. And he has done that throughout his life. Let's not forget, this guy's had a tough go of it. Let's be fair. I mean, horrific tragedy, a stuttering problem that he worked very hard to overcome. People doubting him at every turn. He ran for president multiple multiple times, failed miserably, and here he is. He wasn't going to give up without a fight. Now, that all having been said...
Who were the potential rivals?
Well, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. If Gretchen Whitmer were...
Who's she now?
She is the governor of Michigan, which is a battleground state. She has very strong appeal across the aisle. She is very well got in middle America. She has a track record of working with Republicans. She's a young woman. She is a very strong candidate, very articulate, very able. I think she is somebody who an awful lot of Americans would have rallied around. And again, Mary has talked about women in America and that vote. I think she would have rallied them to an extent that Joe Biden is not capable of. And I believe that she would defeat Donald Trump.
So to that end, and on what you might call the woman thing, should Trump just suck it up and pick Nikki Haley as his running mate?
He absolutely should. You know, that's...
Really?
At first, I would have said absolutely not because, look, he called her bird brain. He hates her. But he wants to beat Joe Biden. He wants it bad. And I just wonder if his family, his closest advisors might say to him, look, the others, yeah, they kiss up to you. They say everything you want. But Nikki Haley can possibly deliver another presidency for you because...
And you can kind of disregard the vice president once you get in anyway, can't you? Like, he doesn't have to have anything more to do with her.
Oh, absolutely. He would have absolutely nothing to... I mean, you know, people talk about how Joe Biden hasn't been very good to Kamala Harris. I mean, it would be a lot worse if she were there. But if... He gets the sense, and I think he has to know that she is easily the best person. I wonder if he can be prevailed upon, if he can see beyond his hatred. She stayed in the race longer, and Trump, it really got under Trump's skin. You could see it.
And she would bring a kind of a moderate-ish element with her while still being acceptable to MAGA.
Well, I don't think MAGA would love it, but it's classic political triangulation. Yeah. Where else are they going to go?
Yeah, apparently, I saw a report of a dinner during the week where Trump had a load of movers and shakers and top business people, and he went around the table and said, who should I pick for my running mate? And they all told him Nikki Haley, apparently. Jared Howland, do you think he's going to win?
I think there's a chance above 50% that he will. I don't know how.
Come on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I think,
for 50-50.
It's better than 50-50. Trump has a better than 50-50 chance of winning the election in November. And part of this poll that, or two polls that are being reported on today in the Mail on Sunday, is, you know, Trump is down not just with young people, but with Hispanic women and black women and men. So those are his base. Find that Trump is losing some Republican voters, exactly the sort of people a Nikki Haley candidacy could bring back. But on the basics, he has a slight advantage, and the consequence of that for the world is momentous.
Yeah. Mary, is there... I mean, it was always a bit dark, maybe, but does there seem to be a new darkness about him and about the way he's communicating? He's very, very angry right now, isn't he?
He's a very, very angry man. I think the being defeated in 2020 just totally destabilised him in some way, in that Trump doesn't take defeat easily or setbacks easily. And, you know, I think Larry's right. His main focus now is defeating Joe Biden and becoming getting back into the White House, where he thinks he was robbed of. I mean, I think he still believes that was a rigged election.
As do a lot of Americans.
Yes,
yeah.
But I think with Biden, unfortunately, there's another cohort who would be very important for the Democratic campaign in leading up to the election, the ones who go out, knock on doors and man the phones, and that is students. And students in America now are being very radicalized because of what is happening in Gaza. And they are turning against maybe not so much Democratic politics, but against Biden because of his seemingly inability to, come to any solution. Yeah. With Netanyahu and the Israelis around that.
We come back to Israel in just one second. Just before we leave this, Larry, briefly, what you were saying about that court case.
Yeah, I think I'll try to be brief.
Just for people who don't know, you're very Democrat.
I'm a Democrat,
yeah.
but I'm also a lawyer. And so much of the coverage of this, if you watch American cable news, so-called legal experts, their perspective on the case was so skewed by their ideological point of view. It was extraordinary.
So everything Trump is telling his people it's correct then?
Well, I've said it before. I don't believe this prosecution should have been brought. The prosecution won it because they did a superb job and the case was defended terribly. But I just want to say,
This was a political hit job on Trump, you're saying, as a Democrat.
By an elected district attorney who pledged to get Trump. It points out a huge systemic failing in the United States. It is crazy that we elect prosecutors. It is also crazy that many places in the United States elect judges. That's bonkers. But one of the things we never got to in this case was to look at the applicable statute, something I tell my students to do. The statute required an intent to defraud. We had no evidence on that. Who exactly was defrauded? Who suffered as a result of Donald Trump, cooking the books effectively on this? Nobody did. They didn't establish that. And why the defense didn't gear it more towards that is crazy to me. Also, why the defense didn't argue more strongly on the statute of limitations issue, I can't understand. This is 2017 stuff. Today it's 2024. I don't understand all of this. I know there's arguments on the other side, but why didn't the defense ventilate that more fully? Lastly, why didn't the defense object when Stormy Daniels went into lurid detail, which we're certainly not going to repeat here, because that obviously would have colored the jury's perception and again, damaged Donald Trump's credibility.
So lots of groans for appeal there. No, of course, Declan Lynch makes the point in the Sunday Independent today that the people who suffered were the American people, the American elections, and all of that.
That's fair. But yeah. Look, the act happened in 2017. They'd already elected Trump.
Okay, so then we move on to the related area that Mary brought up there of Israel. So, Elaine, you've picked a piece in the Sunday Independent, Biden's ceasefire plan shot down.
Yeah.
So it's now Biden's ceasefire plan. Biden tried to tell us initially it was an Israel's plan. It was somebody in Israel's plan, but not the people in charge in Israel.
Yeah, and I think the framing of this as well, when Biden came out on Friday night saying that it was up to Hamas to accept this deal, it was a very good deal for Hamas, and that basically it was coming from Israel, or so that was the way it was framed by the President of the United States. We now have Hamas saying that they would accept this deal, but it's the Israelis who are standing back from it. We have two very senior ministers in Israel this morning saying that they will leave government if Benjamin Netanyahu accepts this deal. And Netanyahu himself has said that his priority is still to take down Hamas, and that has not changed. So I think that's interesting, and US politics comes in there, I think, in the way it was initially framed.
Yeah. So, Jared, is that what was going on there? Biden was coming out after Trump had done his big rant and Trump getting a lot of oxygen. Everyone's waiting for Biden's response to this. He didn't want to give it too much oxygen, so he wanted something else in that speech. So he conjured up a peace plan, not for the first time, Israel allegedly offering a peace plan that Gaza accepts, that Israel then say, we weren't offering this.
Yeah, I mean, there's been various versions of various plans that one side says you know, accepted by the other, and then the other said no. They didn't accept. The politics between Netanyahu, the now Israeli Prime Minister, and Biden are quite fraught. The leaders of the Congress on both sides of the aisle in both houses have invited Netanyahu to address both houses, which is obviously a big political boost for a man who couldn't get into the White House when Joe Biden was first elected. When you speak of an Israeli government, you have to speak very carefully, because certainly there's a government with a prime minister and ministers and so forth, but it is internally divided very deeply, as indeed is Israeli opinion and society. And essentially, Netanyahu, depending on which way you wait to look at it, and various hours of the day you can look at it in both ways, he is completely dependent on two extreme right-wing ministers and their members of the Knesset to stay in power. He is either, depending on what you want to believe, their prisoner who has no way back past them, or actually he is the very Machiavellian user of those people to do what he wants to do anyway. And it's hard to divine the truth. In addition, there are people in that government, which the government absolutely depends upon, who have told him, frankly, unless he does sort some sort of a deal, they are going to leave the government. So can this Israeli government last is one huge question. And the other question is this, that as this goes on and on, a man called Bibi Netanyahu was apparently destroyed politically when that horrific invasion and mutilation and massacre by Hamas took place last October, who was politically finished, is now slowly reviving. there is a real chance that if this government did fall apart and if there was an election, he could be back again.
Do you think?
I wouldn't rule it out, given how fractious Israeli politics is and given how he has astutely, cynically, appallingly, whatever word you want to use, yes, but he is crawling back out of the political
abyss. That's depressing stuff, because everyone seems to agree that a change of leadership in both jurisdictions is what needs to happen.
However, you do not write that man off.
Yeah, so Mary, back to what you were saying there about that, you know, Biden needs to sort this in some way because he's leeching away the younger generation. So did you see this as Biden and America saying, enough now, enough?
I think so. I mean, I can't understand why they haven't done it earlier, because this is the starvation and the killing in Gaza is just extreme at this stage. And the living conditions there are horrific. And why Biden hasn't at this stage tried to bring Netanyahu to the table. A number of times Hamas have accepted, whether they would keep to it or not is another question, ceasefire deals. But at this stage, with Netanyahu saying he will not stop until, or the army will not stop until Hamas are destroyed and total victory. Well, you can never have total victory. We know that as a historian, but in all wars, there's no such thing as total victory. That can't happen. So at this stage, there has to be a negotiated ceasefire. When that will happen, and I disagree slightly there with you, Jared, in that I think Netanyahu is actually in control of this situation.
He may well be.
And he was in deep trouble if he had been out of power. There were court cases coming up against him in the same way, obviously, that has happened with Trump. So because he's now a war president and, you know, leading Israeli against this existentialist threat and real threat to their very existence, he's able to stay in power. And I think you're right, he might actually get elected back into power if there were election. But I also think that what is unrepresented in the media reporting is there is a small but growing opposition to the war in Gaza within Israel.
Oh, sorry, it's a very large opposition.
And the fact that the hostages have seemed to have slipped down the the plan for ending the war in Gaza is extraordinary, and that they haven't tried to get them back. It's an absolute mess for everybody at this stage, and I think Biden has overshot his support of Netanyahu, and it's impacting on him domestically, and that is going to be a big problem for him.
So, Larry, was this a big step? Was Biden saying America has had enough?
You know, it's very difficult to know. Biden is caught between a rock and a hard place. Of course, as Mary indicates, there is some erosion on the left and among young people, which he certainly doesn't need ahead of the election. But on the flip side, and again, I get a sense over here sometimes that people are almost willing America to be in a better position, to be more on the side of the Palestinians. And they're making assumptions that I think don't exist. If you look at the opinion polling, Americans are broadly still supportive of Israel. For instance, the most recent polling data I've seen, say 60% say, yes, Israel should stop their attacks and the horrible things that are going on, but only after Hamas is gone. So some of what's imagined out there is that, you know, Biden is really screwing everything up and this is going to take him down. The numbers just don't reflect that yet.
Okay, so Biden doesn't need to a deal to get done there. He doesn't need to stop
Now. No, certainly a deal would be a showstopper. Yeah. But what I'm saying is he's between a rock and a hard place on this one. He's damned if he does, okay. He's damned if he doesn't.
Jared, before we leave this, there's a related piece by Alison O'Connor in the Sunday Times that you wanted to mention.
Yes, it's about our very small Jewish community here in Ireland. It's a little bigger than people think because we have a traditional community that's been here for many generations, and we've new arrivals working in our tech industries from Jewish communities around the world. So it is a little bigger than we seem. But it is a group of people who feel very under pressure, who feel that this is now a hostile environment for them. I've spoken to a number of people personally, and they don't have any conspiracy theories. Several prominent members of the Jewish community have spoken very frankly about their view of the Netanyahu government in particular. They're much more concerned, I think, about Hamas and the lack of focus of Hamas than is present in our public conversation generally. But aside from that, they feel under pressure as Jews living in our society at this time. And I think Alison O'Connor's piece brought that out very well. The manner in which President Higgins spoke, I think, a little too preemptorily in relation to those concerns was a pity, given that he has a very important, I suppose, role in speaking for all of us and the best of us. And I think it would be helpful if he reflected on that. The chief rabbi, the new and young man, I haven't met him, who has arrived in Ireland recently, he has had some things to say. And I just think we need to be sensitive, both in terms of the complexity of Israeli politics, which we're largely either uninterested in or unaware of, but particularly in the correlation of Jews and Israel in our conversation. And it goes back, by the way, to Catholicism. If you go back, and Mary is a historian, there was an assumption for hundreds of years that Catholicism was akin to disloyalty to the crown. And there's an assumption now that, you know, Jews everywhere, Israel, and then there's some, not, I hesitate to use it because it's much, much too overused, a degree of anti-Semitism that is sometimes used in assuming things about Jews, their power, their money, their privilege, their access, which of course are anti-Semitic tropes and are sometimes inappropriately used.
Mary, you wanted to come in there?
Yes, I think there is a degree of anti-Semitism creeping into our language when we talk about Israel, but I think actually mostly it's anti-Zionism, which is a very different thing. And I know a lot of people equate the two, but that they are not equated. You can be anti-Zionist and not anti-Semitic. And there definitely is a significant number of Irish Jewish people who are actually active in the marches for Palestine, calling for ceasefires, who are absolutely horrified by what the Israeli government is doing. Not the country of Israel, and they're not against that. They're against this very, very right-wing, hard right-wing Israeli government and its response to what were the horrific events of October the 7th. But since then, October the 7th has been overshadowed but by massacre and starvation and destruction. As an academic, I am absolutely horrified the fact that every university in Gaza is now bombed out of existence. There are no schools, there are no infrastructure. Basically, they're destabilizing and decreating in many ways a society, a culture, a people. And a lot of Irish Israelis, a lot of Jewish people living in Ireland are horrified by that and are participating in the marches and in campaigns to bring about a ceasefire.
But just to say, you don't have to be against that or on that side to be a good Jew. And I think we need to be very careful about this.
Well,
if you're Jewish,
you can come back in, Mary.
But I think Jewish people are entitled to the full range of opinions and need to be respected on that basis in relation to the difference, and there's an enormous difference, between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism, as I understand it, is a belief in the right of the existence of a state of Israel to exist as a homeland for the Jewish people. It could be big, it could be small, it could be liberal, it could be illiberal, it could be... But Zionism is about that homeland concept. So if you're anti-Zionism, are you against the existence of a state of Israel? And the consequences of that implicitly involve such an effect, an outcome for the Jewish population in that area. It's hard to say that I wouldn't be anti-Semitic.
I wouldn't see anti-Zionism in that definition. I would say anti-Zionist is about being against a settler colonial apartheid system existing in the state of Israel.
And
Israel
Zionist,
can exist, but it should be inclusive of all its population, both Jewish and Palestinian. And if that can't work, then maybe talk about two-state solution. But also, if you look, if we take our view off Gaza at the moment and look at what's happening in the West Bank and those Zionists who are, as we speak, continuing to exclude and evict Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank, killing many of them. Hundreds have been killed in the last 8 months. So that is what I see as a Zionist project.
But I just want to pick up on this, because I actually went to the synagogue this week and met and spoke to the new chief rabbi, Yoni Vider. And he had a number of things to say, such as what Gerard is reflecting there, that Jewish people in Ireland do feel under pressure, do feel isolated. But he did point out that there's been no violence against Jewish people here. And it is a feeling more that they feel like they can't perhaps wear items that point them out as being Jewish now.
They're keeping their heads down. Would that be a fair thing to say?
That is what the chief rabbi was saying.
That's the vibe I get from anyone I've spoken to.
Also in that interview, the chief rabbi had a number of other things to say, which I'm not sure if all the Jewish community in Ireland would reflect. One of which, he said that the ratio of civilians to militants is a good ratio in Gaza compared to other conflicts. Now, the UN would dispute that. They would say that we've had more children killed in Gaza since October 7th than the previous 4 years of all world conflicts. Yep. He was very keen to point out that this is Hamas's fault and not Israel's fault that civilians are being killed, pointing to Hamas using it as human shields and going into areas that have been designated as humanitarian zones.
Okay.
So very interesting opinions there, and his opinions also were given at a rally last weekend. He came out against President Higgins, and again, I feel like I'm publicising myself, but it was from an interview I did with him that he said that perhaps that anti-Semitism is not as prevalent, I'm paraphrasing, but as people feel, that it's coming from the community who feel scared themselves rather than it being out there as a real and defined thing. And we saw it before.
Jared, I have to take a break.
This conversation in the last few minutes has reflected better the complexity than most conversation in public in Ireland in the last weeks and months.
Okay. Well done, everyone. So, Gerard Howland, Lane Loughlin, Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Larry Donnelly staying with us. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Gerard Howland, Elaine Loughlin, Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Larry Donnelly are still with us. And now we'll start rocketing on now, but I do want to talk about our own politics a little bit. Elaine, we won't get too bogged down in this, but there is another poll in the Sunday Independent today, largely reflecting what all the polls over the last few weeks have been telling us. Will you just give us a brief rundown of the stage of the parties there?
Yes, and I think it's a poll that new enough Taoiseach now, Simon Harris, will probably be happy with. Fine Gael on 22%, neck and neck with Sinn Féin, that is also on 22%, Fianna Fáil on 17%. And another interesting point to take from this poll is independents and others are now at 23%. So based on that poll, I think Jody Corcoran of the Sunday Independent is saying that independents... further down the list. And so you have the Social Democrats on 5%, the Greens on 4%, Aon Thú Padraig Tobin's party on 3%, the Labour Party also on 3%, and PBP Solidarity on 2%.
Okay, and that poll was taken on Thursday and Friday last, May 30 to 31. Sample size is 1,770 and the margin of error is 2.4%. And off you go. So you were saying about Jody Corcoran's
piece. What I was picking up on, and Jody is doing an analysis of those results and stating that based on those figures, that 23% that independents and others now enjoy, that they are in position to take a seat in each of the European constituencies. Now, you could counter that in saying that there is so many in the field in each of those European constituencies. Could they perhaps do themselves down, I suppose? You look at Midlands North West, there's 23 or 27 candidates. I'm not going to mention
them. No names.
But 15 of those are independent and others. Ireland South, 23 candidates, 12 of whom are independent or others. And Dublin has 23 candidates as well, 14 of whom you could put in that independents or others bracket. So there's a potential there that unless one of them is very strong, and no names given again, that they could cancel each other out.
You will need to break away from the herd there, and anything could happen. Really, it still has that sense, doesn't it? Larry, you picked a piece that's kind of along the lines of what we've been saying. Gary Murphy's piece about volatility.
Yeah, just pointing out how voters have been really all over the shop, that we've had massive swings in recent elections. And one wonders what that augurs for the upcoming second order elections. Just two things on the party rankings or standings. One, I think, is the important point about independents and others is that they are a diverse group. I think a lot of people immediately leap to say the rise of the right, et cetera. They're in a diverse group. And also, another thing to note is that this is about general election voting preferences. So the extent to which this might be borne out in second order elections, I think, is an open question. The other thing to note, obviously, is that Sinn Féin's precipitous seeming drop continues. And again, a lot of commentary out there is focused, and I think correctly, on the fact that it's kind of squeezed on the left and on the right, and the immigration issue hasn't worked out well for it. And it makes me wonder, I suppose, ahead of these elections. Obviously, in 2020, the big story was Sinn Féin didn't run enough candidates. Now, with the Europeans and the locals ahead, I wonder if Sinn Féin might have run too many candidates.
Okay. in that piece, Jody Corcoran makes a case for a tribe of floating voters who, in Phil Hogan's phrase, Fine Gael barred them from Fianna Fáil after
very
the crash.
Very wittily written piece.
Yeah. It's good. He paints us a picture of this notional person. Then went to Sinn Féin.
Well, some of them
and
are
now it has.
I promise you.
And now has coalesced kind of around independence. Do you think that's a fair summing of the situation?
Yes, and I hope I'm not over extrapolating from Jody Corcoran's piece, but Fianna Fáil historically was at 40%. If it's lucky, it's at 20%. Where are those 20%? They're all over the place is the short answer, but they haven't gone away. And their sort of aspirational politics hasn't gone away, but they themselves are overwhelmingly more middle class than working class, at least in terms of their origin and self view.
So what would you say it all means for, would you make any predictions for next week, or do you think it's impossible to say?
Well, I tell you what, these polls today represent the starting line, not the finishing line. When this poll was taken, people were just beginning to take a serious interest. People are deciding later and later. The first decision people will make, it's the most important one, is whether they'll vote at all. It was about a 50% turnout the last time. And those who do turn out, what will they do? And most decisions that will affect the outcomes have yet to be taken.
Okay. Mary, you picked a piece by Ali Bracken in the Sunday Independent. Gardaí ready for far-right unrest ahead of Euro and local votes.
Yeah, I think, when you mine down into the independents, as everyone has said, they're a very, very, very diverse group. But there is quite a lot running on the right and far right. And they're running on issues of, it's a kind of a Trumpian culture war issue based candidacy. Many of them were invading libraries earlier last year and things like that. Again, no names and all that sort of thing. But they are running on anti-migrant, anti-vax, quite a number of them on trans issues and those culture war LGBT issues. I don't think they're transfer friendly. They'll get their small vote. I think also there's a number of those far right parties that are fighting with each other, and they're all running candidates seemingly as independents, but they are running them within that general umbrella. I don't think any of them will get elected, but I think they may cause. The problem with the Gardaí is, I would say the Gardaí think they will cause issues at count centres because they're using that, American culture war trope of rigged elections, of people, ballot box stuffing, of ballots disappearing. And the thing is, we have in Ireland a really robust electoral system that works and has worked for generations. The people, obviously, there have been attempts over the years that we all know, like newspaper stories many years ago of people voting two or three times and all that sort of thing. But generally,
Patrick Connor.
Exactly. That generally doesn't happen. So we have a robust electoral system. And I don't think any of these far-right candidates will make a huge impression on the polls or get many votes outside of their own cohort.
But you think they might cause trouble?
But I think they may cause trouble. I have no doubt that they will cause trouble because they do it all the time. That is their raison d'etre. And because they reject the elite political establishment, the media establishment, the intellectual establishment, all of the elites, they're about rejecting what exists in our society and wanting to create a different thing. And so our electoral system to them is rigged.
I can imagine what they're saying now, listening to this elite D4 discussion now.
Elaine. Brendan, to pick up on that, it's almost the threat of disruption as well. And I know Ali Bracken's piece is talking about the possibility of pop-up protests if the ballot doesn't go the way that they hope or anticipate. But as someone who has an office in Leinster House, I have had difficulty getting in numerous times since last September when we did see those really nasty protests outside Leinster House and gallows erected with politicians' faces on it. And a lot of the time, something will go up on Telegram or one of the social media sites that there's going to be a protest. The entirety of the city centre is locked down and no one shows up. So it's even just the threat of something happening now that can really cause a lot of disruption for regular people in Dublin city centre just wanting to get to work.
Larry, you want to get
in there? I'm not attempting to minimise the threat, which obviously needs to be taken seriously. But I do wonder, I mean, what I encounter commonly, and I think Jared referred indirectly to this, is apathy, a huge sense of apathy around these elections. People just aren't tuned in. There's a tremendous amount of indifference.
Yeah, Elaine, have you been out? Is it a flat campaign?
It does. And what many TDs and councillors are saying is they're, people are answering the doors. A lot of people are working from home now. So there are people at home ready to engage, but they're not engaging. They're smiling, they're nodding, they're taking the leaflet and they're closing the door. They're not necessarily raising issues. Now, obviously, you see from the poll today that housing is still the top issue, followed by migration, the likes of health as well is in the mix. But I think it is flat. People are, maybe they're just content. The weather's nice. They're not really thinking, they're not angry enough to maybe confront those who are.
That's the first time anyone said people aren't angry enough in a while. Now, Jared, you want to come in there briefly?
The majority of people.
Yeah. As part of my homework for you, I talked to a few hardy canvassers last night and yesterday, and exactly what Elaine said, doors have been opened, largely polite, a conversation, and very little clue.
OK, listen, I'm going to rock on a bit because I do want to get to the Children's Hospital, which was a big story this week. And people were angry about this all over again, Elaine. So the Mail on Sunday, we can't blacklist Children's Hospital builders you picked.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's an interesting one that ministers did discuss the possibility of not allowing BAM to tender for other state projects that come up. And obviously EU procurement laws are cited as a factor that you cannot take into account previous performance when tendering for large scale jobs as that. But I think my opinion on it would be that we possibly should be careful what we wish for in that instance, because while the Children's Hospital is getting a lot of attention for very good reasons, and Chair of the Board David Gunning was before the PAC this week detailing further cost overruns and further time overruns, and it may be as late as 2026 now before a single child gets into that hospital. But if you drilled down perhaps to other public projects that don't get the attention that the Children's Hospital has got, doesn't perhaps have the budget, they might have also gone over time and over budget, and we could be ruling almost every contractor out in the country.
Okay, yeah, and we'll recall that BAM offered to walk away. No, I mean, they kind of had them at that stage anyway. There was no way you could have brought in someone else, but they said we are happy to walk away from this if the government wants, and the government got manners fairly quickly and said no. Jared, you've been following this forensically. Just give us a couple of minutes of your observations.
So you have to go back to the Mater Hospital in 2012. There was to be a new children's hospital on that site. It didn't happen, and Bord Pleanála rejected. In the aftermath of that, there was an absolute determination to do something, to do it as quickly as possible. The James's Hospital site was picked. That was quite controversial, but there you are, and forward from there we went. And by 2016, when Leo Varadkar was Minister for Health, it was decided that this was going ahead. And 2017, when Simon Harris was Minister, this tender emerged. And everything that happened since goes to the terms and conditions of that tender. It separated design from build. Why? So the time wouldn't be lost. What was the reason for that? Was it the good reason, we want to treat children as soon as possible? Or was there political reason to get a project over the line, shovels in the ground, so as to demonstrate political capacity?
Okay, but the seeds were sown then.
Absolutely. The problem is the contract. It separated the design from build. It also set up this new governance board at the hospital, which David Gunning is the CEO. But they effectively report to the Department of Health and the HSE, which in turn, of course, has to act in concert with the Department of Public Expenditure. And because the design issues are separate, effectively it gives enormous power to the contractor. Okay. And that is why this issue is recurring. And what surprises me is it's beloved of parliamentary committees to bring in the hospital and interrogate them fairly about delays and changes in design. But it, as the relevant policy committee, has done nothing, to my knowledge, about investigating and coming up with recommendations about how these tenders should be done better in future, which, as Elaine
brilliant.
Said...
Brilliant. So it's nobody's child. We'll make a committee.
Exactly.
And we will... A man of straw, I believe, would be the legal phrase there.
And we will ballyrag you endlessly,
okay.
Repeatedly.
Okay.
But as the legislators, we'll be come up with a better strategy and...
Okay, well, that's a take. All right, from Gerard Howland. And Gerard Howland, Elaine Loughlin, Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Larry Donnelly are staying with us, but I have to take another quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Gerard Howland, Elaine Loughlin, Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Larry Donnelly are still with us. Just before we move on, just in case I forget to read this out, there's a few texts along these lines. Frank says, I just want to say that the discussion on the Gaza conflict just now was the most insightful and balanced discussion I've heard on the subject. It's pity more people don't ignore the social media diatribe that pollutes the airwaves. Regards, Frank. So well done and thank you everyone on that. Now, Mary, Luke O'Neill is writing about turbulence today, and of course we've all had the frighteners put on us now about this clear air turbulence that we never knew anything about.
Absolutely. We've read articles over the last few days about people, one person unfortunately dying and people getting injured because of this clear air turbulence. And of course, you know, when you're flying, you sometimes get a voice from the cockpit saying, we're hitting turbulence now, please take your seats and put on your seatbelts. And while that turbulence is often quite scary, we're very used to it in terms of if you're flying, particularly on long haul flights. But this clear air turbulence caused by climate change, which is impacting, and I think...
Well, exacerbated by climate change.
Yeah. And again, it shows how climate change is impacting everything in our lives. It can't be detected. So you could be wandering around the airplane, maybe going to the loo or just stretching your legs, and suddenly you hit
the
ceiling.
Okay, stop. Larry's freaking out here. You're a terrified frequent flyer.
Yes, my condolences to any Aer Lingus personnel who are listening to this, who practically wind up holding my hand on transatlantic flights. I'm so scared. But the thoughts of this, as Mary says, it's one thing if the pilot says, no, we're going to hit a patch. Now, that's bad enough because I'm still gripping the seat. But when it happens all of a sudden, I'm sorry. And a lot of people, Luke O'Neill included, say, oh, it's really nothing to worry about. Keep your seatbelt on. Tell me that when I look on the screen and I'm in a little dot in the middle of the Atlantic and the plane starts to shake. It's not really comforting.
Okay, but we should say, just for, you know, balance and everything, that Luke still points out that air travel is still one of the safest things. We saw awful tragedies recently, but air travel is still very safe. But probably, you know, they do always say when you're sitting down, keep the seatbelt on. Probably
I think we will have to do that now. And I always do that anyway whenever I'm flying. But people do wander around the aircraft on long haul flights, but I think we've got deep vein thrombosis we need to worry about as well, there's so many concerns when you're up in the air.
Stand up and exercise and wiggle your toes.
Exactly, you have to stretch the legs and everything. Yeah. Elaine, we just have time before we go for the Business Post piece that the 1990s and 2000 clothes brands are enjoying a share price renaissance.
Yeah, back to the 90s with your low-slung jeans and belly tops. Abercrombie & Fitch has almost doubled its share price already this year and is up 475% over the last 12 months.
Was it not practically cancelled a couple of years ago? It was over, wasn't it?
You definitely weren't seeing anyone between the ages of 14 and 18 wearing it for a long time, which was not the case in the noughties. And similarly, Uggs, those terrible nightmares boots from them.
Yeah. Furry Wellingtons.
Furry Wellingtons, yeah. 127% increase.
I am a proud owner of a pair of Uggs as a utilitarian thing for winter swimming. And I can't say I don't hang around Dundrum in them or anything, but they are... They are a good, stylish footwear. I'm back.
It seems like I'm back. Well, look,
if the 1990s and the 2000s are back, I'm absolutely back. Okay, thank you very much to my panel this morning. Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Times contributor. Elaine Loughlin, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Dr. Mary McAuliffe, UCD historian and lecturer in gender studies. And Larry Donnelly, columnist with the journal.ie and lecturer in law at NUI Galway. Thank you for giving up your bank holiday, guys, and doing all your homework and coming into us.